Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
Weekdays from 7.
Damon Dunphy, I'm convinced that Rory McIlroy, this is his year for the Masters.
Well, I backed him last week. He certainly got the game for the course, but what's clear is there are an awful lot of seriously good young players around now. And in the time that Rory was injured and having problems with his game, I think a lot of people have passed him. But the raw talent he's got, you know, and as we saw last week, he can be majestic and definitely has the game for Augusta. Yeah. So we'll see. But there's a lot of guys now, really seriously good players who can win.
I can tell you that Gary Murphy really, really fancies Justin Thomas.
He's absolutely right. This kid, he's the guy I was going to mention.
Yeah.
I mean, he is amazing. He's got power, and that's all he had, really. But now he's got a game. He's shaping the ball. His putting is good. He's won 8 times in 47 tournaments.
Yeah.
Which is unbelievable.
Phenomenal.
Now, he's a prolific winner. And Rory, for all his talent, has never been a prolific winner. He's won 4 majors, but he is, you know, when he's right, he is a fantastic golfer. So you couldn't but fancy him to win the Masters. But he's going to have to be. I watched him this week in the match play, actually. I think his concentration isn't always there.
Yeah, he does seem to switch off at times, doesn't he?
He switches off, and it either happens or it doesn't happen. Whereas someone like Jordan Spieth, you know, they're there all the time, and he's having a nightmare with his game, but he's still in the tournament here. You know, he's still there.
He finds chipping a way
away
to get it done.
Jason Day, when he gets going, they're big players. You know, Phil Mickelson isn't done with for the Masters either.
No, I mean, shaping up to be a cracker.
That's the one thing, Eamon, it's interesting you mentioned that point. That's the one thing I've always found with McIlroy over the years, that there's no in between with him. It's all or nothing. When he's on, he's amazing, but when he's off, he doesn't seem to want to grind it out and fight.
A bit
and
like me,
like some of them that'll dig in and try and rescue a score. It's either I'm going to hit a 64 or it's a 76.
I think that's the thing with him. He's a very gifted lad, but concentration and grinding things out, you know, that's not his thing. And I think probably the champions that he's trying to emulate and has the talent to emulate, like Nicklaus and Palmer, for example, but there are others as well that you could put in the category of, you know, Justin Rose is a good example. You know, Justin's won only one major, but he grinds it out every week, you know. He's there every week. He's in the top 10. Rory can just blow and miss the cut. So this is what he's done this week. I mean, I watched him 2 of his matches all the way, and it was a bit expensive, to be honest.
We've had a text in from Aidan in Dungarvan just before we get to the match tonight, Eamon, which I just want to ask you because it's specifically for you. He says, "Hi,
I'm watching it. It's pretty depressing."
Oh, it's awful. Yeah. Anyway, we'll come back to him in just a second. Just if you wouldn't mind, this one, Aidan says, "Can you please ask Eamon what his views are on the World Cup in Russia with what's going on lately? I remember him saying that he would not travel to France for the Euros for safety reasons. Does he feel similar here?" It's a bit of a mess, really, with diplomats being expelled and
What I said in relation to France, just to be very clear, was that people who are going should be cognizant of the fact that there is terrorism is a risk and something you have to factor into the equation. I didn't say don't go, but I said if son or daughter of mine were going, I would be worried, a little concerned. In terms of the World Cup in Russia, as a general principle, I believe sport should be kept separate from politics. Otherwise, you wouldn't play lots of teams at lots of things in all kinds of sports. In the boycott in South Africa helped to rid that country of apartheid.
Yes.
And the reason it was right for sports people to boycott was because they were discriminating against their own black sportsmen and women. That's the key.
Yeah.
Now, there's not that, and that justified the ban. And can you say that the Russians are discriminating against sports people because of their political views? I would say you couldn't say that. But look at the tyrannies. Look where the World Cup, the Winter Olympics were played in not 2014. It was in
Sochi,
Russia.
Yeah.
You know, there's all kinds of tyrants have hosted games. I mean, Brazil, for example, the South African regime at the moment isn't nice. They got the 2010 World Cup. So it's tricky territory. I do feel if the Russians are going to, you know, murder people and it's state terrorism in other countries, there's only one other country at the moment where it's suspected and proven in the case of Litvinenko in 2010. They did that. Well, then you've got to think. But if you're going to stop playing football, playing sport against people from obnoxious regimes, I don't know where
Well, nothing would ever happen. I mean,
well, that's one argument. The other argument is it's no use England not going because of this dreadful murder. Maybe nobody should be going. Maybe, but I think the world we live in, you know, there's certain people who think America is a, you know, a capitalist hell. And you might stop going there. I think it's better to keep sport and politics separate.
Where you can, where possible.
Generally, sport is benign. But I do think it's a valid question that, you know, there's a line that they appear to have stepped across, the Russians. That,
yeah.
And that they have that doping issue in a big way, state-sponsored doping. The Chinese have had state-sponsored doping. You know, Sonia Sullivan was robbed of a gold medal, you could argue, by three Chinese women, you know, who were had an outboard motor. And I won't name the British athletes who are under suspicion, but there's a lot of them.
There's an awful lot of them, and that's there was Ewan McKenna wrote a piece in the Irish Independent over the weekend highlighting the serious questions that Mo Farah has to answer, which he refuses to answer, or which people just bury their heads in the sand. And the more, you know, it's great to say, okay, well then the Russians are guilty of state sponsored doping, but then you see across the water, you know, 55 minutes in a plane, and people at the top level of sports in Britain can't recognise what's right in front of their face. You really do.
Yes,
it's very hard to kind of say, well, the Russians are the bad guys here.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, it's so Bradley Wiggins is in the frame now. For example, the whole Sky.
Yeah, Chris
team.
Froome and
Froome, all of
massive
them.
Questions. Yeah,
yeah, and the shocking, and you know, there are brave journalists like Paul Kimmich being, you know, the ultimate sort of person in your sport of rugby, Hugh.
Yeah.
Do we know what everyone is taking?
No, is the answer.
And no, and I look at them with the eye of a professional, who's someone who's been a professional and who knows if it's something about the body. A, that I haven't got one, and B, there are certain shapes that human beings aren't meant to be. So I think there's doping in rugby, and I think there's doping in soccer.
I think wherever there's money and a benefit from being successful at sports, there's going to be cheats. And
a will to find out who the cheats are isn't there because of the commercial considerations. And in soccer, for example, would any of those sponsors, any of those TV companies who are pumping money into the game, would they want a performance-enhancing drug scandal? The answer is no, they wouldn't.
Yeah.
And therefore, if they don't want it, will the authorities that run the game pursue it with real vigor?
No, and of course not. If the appetite isn't there no matter what cost to rid a sport of doping, if it means discrediting and ruining sponsors' image and taking money away from it, ultimately there's never going to be the appetite to go and drive it out of the game. So or any sport.
And it's a major problem because the first thing it's really sick, because the first thing a young kid learns when they have talent is they're told by their coach, you're going to have to take this stuff or you're not going to be competitive.
Yeah.
And what do you do if you love a sport? I mean, if someone had said to me when I was 15, I was at United And I was actually, I needed strengthening up. Someone said to me, take that, you'll be strong, and you'll play for Manchester United's first team. I'd have taken it.
Yeah.
And that's the situation in many sports, and maybe even in soccer. There were rumours about the major Spanish clubs. It was proven in Italy in the 80s and later, subsequently, again, and there was some retribution. But I think it's in soccer. I really do.
I think it's, yeah, it's an area.
And I could name names, but you wouldn't like
Please
that.
Please don't. Please don't.
Incidentally, I better not tell you, but there is a major figure in British sport who, as a player, was found guilty of doping himself.
Well,
I won't tell you what his name is, but
don't, yeah.
He's a friend of Alan's.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Okay, we need to talk about the match because we're in the final minute of injury time. It's I don't want to, Charles and Double 12's been on saying, look, lads, I'm a long time listener to the show, and I've even warned to Alan, so please don't be so negative. But it's hard to be positive about what I'm seeing out here, because this is supposed to be a new era. It's the same manager, and it looks like it's the same old problems. Eamon, Aaron can't keep the ball.
Yeah, well, they have new players that. Partnership up front, Hogan and Maguire, neither of them are tall, and we're pumping long balls up to them. It's mad. It really is mad.
Yeah.
This is the football of yesterday, or in fact the day before yesterday, and not playing a particularly good side. The lads are doing their best, but there's no sign that Ireland have really. If you play Maguire and Hogan, you've got to give them a chance, play the ball into feet. If you pump long balls up to them, that's no good. They're not going to win any long balls, so you're not using the attributes that they have. It doesn't look great. Turkey aren't great, but it is only a friendly match. It's the beginning. It should be the beginning of a new era. It's going to be tough enough, but it's very, very, very hard to see Martin O'Neill changing the way he prefers to play. I mean, he played James McLean very deep, almost in the left back position. James McLean is not a left back, he's a very dangerous left winger, and that's just one thing. He's no Wales to get rid of now, so that maybe that makes life easier for him, but he's reported in newspapers to be getting €2 million a year, which makes him probably in the top three internationally for the amount of money he's earning for managing the national team. That's a bit of a scandal.
Kevin Palmer's with us. Hey, Kev.
Hi, guys. How are we?
Kevin, do you know of a single manager, say, operating the top four divisions of English football that names his team like an hour before kickoff? So the players haven't a clue who's playing until an hour before kickoff. Do you know of any manager, or have you heard anecdotally even of that this might happen?
Well, this is the Martin O'Neill sort of ethos that he thinks he's keeping the players on their toes and keeps them. And I don't know any other manager that does this. I think Brian Clough used to do, and I think O'Neill thinks it's worked for me in the past and it'll work for me again. But from first-hand experience of talking to players in the squad, senior players, they don't like this. Players don't want to be told an hour before the game you're playing, especially if you're a young guy and you maybe haven't played too much. No, I always go back to the situation in the Germany game where David Ford and Darren Randolph were both sent to warm up while Keenan O'Neill was sat on the bench trying to work out which one was going on. I mean, it just shows the lack of planning in a basic decision like that. You should know who your number two goalkeeper is. And David Ford said to me, he literally, and Randolph said, they just didn't know, there was no nod and a wink, you're the number two. I mean, that shouldn't happen. And it just highlights the lack of planning for me
How do you plan for anything if nobody knows who's playing?
Well, I mean, how do you prepare? The training ground, every team now works on preparation, particularly for an international team. You need to use the 4 days you've got to work with the group that are going to play as a group. Set pieces. We give a stupid goal tonight away from a set piece, and just before we gave the goal away, we should have given another goal away from a set piece. Now, you can't work on set pieces if you don't know who's going to be in the team.
I think as well, Hugh, looking at this, I don't think we should be surprised, because this has been Martin O'Neill over the past two or three years, and all the talk was after the last campaign and how bad it was. He still came out fighting, and he's a very stubborn man, and how defensive he was when questioned on different tactics and different substitutions he made. So if we thought that things are going to change now in his new two-year contract and for the next campaign, we were all... it's lunacy to think he's going to change. This is his way, whether we like it or not. I certainly don't like it, as you know.
Is he really getting $2 million a year? Is that the salary?
That's the report.
That's what it was. Yeah.
Kevin might know. He's a proper journalist.
There was a situation with Dennis O'Brien, wasn't there? Paying some of his salary. Now that's gone.
I've seen newspaper reports in recent weeks saying that that is his salary.
That was certainly the widespread opinion. Yeah.
I'd say Gareth Southgate maybe is the only person, international team manager, on more.
€2 million a year for Martin.
And then you've got Keane as well. Mm. That's too shocking.
Much. That's shocking. I'm sorry. That's indefensible. How can the FAI stand over that?
Well, they should be asked, but they don't hold many press conferences, do they? That you can really, you know, ask questions of them. It should be asked, for example, when they publish their annual accounts, you should be able to identify the salary of the coach. So, but for what he's paid, if he was paid, you know, €20, I mean, some people would consider it a privilege and an honour to coach their country. You should still be doing the right things. And there's no evidence from this evening. Now, you don't want to draw too many adverse conclusions from one game, but there's no sign that the style is going to change, and the style is redundant.
Kevin, you've an interesting take on Martin O'Neill's version of events as regards to Liam Kelly. So during the week, Martin O'Neill says, I never heard back from Liam Kelly until he got a text message to say he's not interested in joining up with the squad. You have a slightly different version of what happened.
I have to be careful what I say. I'm good pals with Liam's people around him and whatever else. But just very quickly on what we were talking about before, Marcello Lippi, £18 million a year to be China boss. Can you believe that? That's
wow.
Actually true as well. So we're getting Martin O'Neill cheap.
Martin O'Neill's getting ripped off. Yeah.
Yeah. Liam Kelly, partly going back to where we were before, is a player of Liam Kelly's sort of style going to get into this Martin O'Neill Ireland team? He's a sort of a young man. He's short in stature, but he's very, very talented, been in good form for Reading despite their struggles at the wrong end of the championship. And I can categorically tell you that at no point has he said he's keeping his options open in trying to play for England. That's not how this happened. Liam has never said that to anybody. Whether Martin O'Neill's been given a message that might be how he's leaning, if that is the case, then Martin's been given the wrong information, because that isn't what Liam's thinking at all. He was quite happy to come over this week. The main problem is he's got a very badly swollen ankle that was kicked on 3 or 4 weeks ago. He's been playing on it with painkillers, and they've been icing it every day, and he wasn't ready to come over, and he said at the moment it wasn't right for him to come over. Now, O'Neill, we think, has been told something by someone else, maybe at Reading, that has slightly gone out of control, and it's very unfortunate the way it's come out this week, because Liam looks like he's another Jack Grealish, as they were saying on the radio. But
how does that get lost in translation then? If Liam Kelly is saying, look, I've got a swollen ankle at the moment, so therefore I'm not available at the moment, but I'm still interested in playing for the Republic of Ireland. And Martin O'Neill says, no, he ignored my calls. I tried 3 or 4 times, and then I get a text message of him saying he's not interested. They're two very different versions of the same story.
Well, Martin O'Neill said that the text said it wasn't right for me at the moment. Now, that's what Martin O'Neill said. So I think somewhere along the way, somebody maybe at Reading who clearly they weren't keen for Liam to go, because he's their best player at the moment. They're in a real relegation battle. They've just sacked their manager, and they were probably looking for a route to make sure Liam didn't go on this international trip. And would he have played tonight? I very much doubt it. I mean, you can't see a Lionel Messi style little player being stuck in the middle of an Ireland team at the moment with Martin O'Neill.
Kevin, can I just jump in there, because if that's the case and that's the side of the story that you're saying, obviously with Liam and his people, surely though there should be no text message sent at all, and whoever sent that's wrong for a start, because if Liam is, whatever way he's swaying towards playing for Ireland or playing for England or whatever the case may be, surely he picks up the phone and rings the manager himself.
he's, yeah. I mean, listen, Liam's a very shy lad, and I've tried to get
someone because if he's, as you said, he's come out of it looking like the bad lad now because of the miscommunication. But
yeah,
and as much as I want to defend the lad and listen to your side of the story, and that's fine if that's the side of it, because we've seen this before with Martin O'Neill in terms of him not actually going straight for the player and having that communication. I think the lad should, there should be no text messages. He should be ringing the manager himself directly, or getting his manager at Reading or someone to pass on the proper information that what needs to be passed on before any of this gets out in a press conference.
That's fair enough.
Correct. I can't deny that. But, you know, I mean, look, at the end of the day, Martin O'Neill's kind of come out straight away and put it in a very public forum and made Liam look terrible, you know. So Liam probably then should come out and do a more of a... I did a story in Independent IE last night, sort of trying to sort of give a few hints as to what may have happened here. But I think at the moment, you know, Liam Kelly might not be jumping up and down at the prospect of going to play for a Martin O'Neill Ireland team. That might be somewhere within the mix here, but you know,
in fairness to Martin O'Neill, then, like, if Martin O'Neill has rang this guy, whatever, and he doesn't, and then gets a text message that's kind of confusing and hard to decipher, like, that's not Martin O'Neill's fault, is it? I mean, this guy, if Liam Kelly has been asked to play for Republic of Ireland, he should be either saying yes or no, and that's
hold on now. I mean, Jack Charlton went to Oxford to talk personally to Ray Houghton and John Aldridge. He went, and he sort of pitched to them. You know, he said, look, we really want you. Will you come? That's what Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane should be doing. I mean, Martin O'Neill in particular, in the Jack Grealish situation, a sarcastic remark about his father from Roy Keane, saying his father was hard work and all of that stuff, that wouldn't have helped. And we lost that guy. Now, this situation shouldn't be down to text messages and phone calls. You go and you persuade the person, you show them respect, and you assure them, and you have a conversation with them about, you know, and you have to use persuasion. You can't just be doing it by text or through newspapers. And it's very, very serious. If what Kevin says there is right, we could be blowing the chance of, you know, getting a very good young player into a green shirt. And I'm sorry, but there's no excuse for making phone calls. Get on an aeroplane, or in O'Neill's case, get on the motorway, go and see the lad, try and develop a relationship with him, explain to him what you're all about, and try to do better than they did with Jack Grealish.
Yeah. Okay.
O'Neill lives half an hour away from Reading, so he shouldn't have any problem getting there.
No, you know? I mean, it's you know, I think this guy is living, well, I mean, look at the money he's getting, the assurances that the FAI won't keep him employed no matter how we play. We'll see what happens the next time they go to the Aviva. I think Irish soccer fans took a very dim view of that contract he didn't sign for over 3 months while he was hunting around and talking to Stoke City and maybe talking to Everton. I think people took a dim view of that, and we'll see what happens next time they give us one of their typical Martin O'Neill performances in the Aviva.
Okay, all right. Listen, lads, we're out of time. Kevin, Eamon, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
See you, lads.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks a lot.